Welcome to Friday. Welcome to KOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke, here to make sense of this week gone by with my panel of friends. Seattle Times political reporter Jim Bruner, The Stranger political reporter Sydney Brownstone, the host of Civic Cocktail on Seattle Channel, Joni Balter. Welcome, everybody.
Hey there.
Thanks.
Hey.
And by the way, join the conversation on Twitter, at KOW. In a few minutes, is it illegal now for you to drink coffee behind the wheel in Washington State? That's coming up. But first, our top story, Obamacare survives. Anyone else watching last night, following in real time?
I did.
When I should have been sleeping?
I caught the vote, and it was interesting to watch on, I don't remember what channel, but watching it live, I think they passed by on the Senate roll call. They passed by McCain's name, and you couldn't really hear anything.
Yeah.
He later comes out and catches the attention of the clerk of the Senate, or whoever it was, gives a quick downturn, and it was shocking. It just didn't seem like people knew what he was going to do until he did it.
There were gasps and applause, and Republican Mitch McConnell said this is bad news.
What we tried to accomplish for the American people was the right thing for the country. I think the American people are going to regret that we couldn't find a better way forward.
Okay, so notice how many times this week President Trump failed to get what he wanted. Trump tweeted that the military will not allow transgender people, and the Pentagon said, that's not our policy. Trump didn't want sanctions on Russia. Congress passed them anyway. Trump wanted Congress to repeal Obamacare, and they haven't done it. Sydney, is Donald Trump less powerful than you feared?
I think it would be too early to make a conclusion on that, because I think he's already subverted a lot of the norms that we've seen from presidents in the past. And I think his use of his executive authority is pushing that office as far as it can go. Just the number of executive orders he signed within the first few weeks of office to, you know, repeal regulations for every one passed. I've never seen anything like that. And I think it would be premature to say that he's less powerful than we imagine him to be. I also think it's better to be safe than sorry.
Joni, when Trump was elected, the next day I interviewed Democratic Congressman Jim McDermott, Democratic former King County Executive Ron Sims, former Washington Attorney General Rob McKenna, Republican, none of whom supported Trump. All of them said, don't panic, we have checks and balances. So far, would you say they've been right?
I'd say they are pretty right about that, if you think about it. You know, Donald Trump is fantastic at driving the conversation. He's pretty bad at governing. He can't really govern. And if you think about it, there was a New York Times piece that made me laugh. He's on track to insult 650 people, places, or things this year. Our government was not set up for dictators. And you actually have to work with people. And there's no better example than the health care bill that failed last night. Oh, we have to change health care, except it only has 17% approval. Well, he should have kept his eye. Somebody should have told him. You don't go around insulting people and getting them over to your side.
You think insults killed the health reform?
Well, you know, but here, I want to talk about the women of the Senate, because they actually know how to work across the aisle. And you had two Republican female senators. It's not uncomfortable for them to vote with the other side, because the women of the Senate, the 20 of them, we've talked about this before on this show, they get together once a month without staff, and they know how to talk to each other. So that was one thing. So this whole week of insulting Lisa Murkowski of Alaska didn't work for him. Think about John McCain, what Donald Trump said a long time ago. He likes people who weren't captured. I kept wondering, and I'm amazed that Mitch McConnell didn't know how John McCain was going to vote. Remember, he was in the hospital. He was not able to fly. But somehow he decided he's going to fly in, and in his case, decide to vote for the motion to proceed to uphold the democracy. But Mitch McConnell didn't know that he was going to vote no. I mean, he should have known that.
Jim Bruner, what have we learned about Trump's potency?
It certainly is a lot harder to get in office and put into effect a policy or bring people on board with your preferred policy than it is to go on Twitter and just make a bunch of statements and say that is the policy. We've clearly learned that. We've clearly learned that, you know, the Trump administration's efforts even to change the narrative by changing their communications personnel hasn't worked out that well this week. The new communications.
Holy smokes!
I mean, that's
an understatement.
That's
all I can say.
For those
and
who
it shows a lack of understanding too of you know,
I want to bring our listeners along so we can they can understand everything we're saying. Just this week, in case you missed it, Trump's new communications director went on a reckless, vulgar tirade against his coworkers.
And what was surprising to me about that, maybe it shouldn't be surprising at this point, is that he then went on Twitter and said, the mistake I made was trusting a reporter. Well, the reporter wrote down what he said and reported it. This is the communications director for the president of the United States, and somehow he doesn't seem to understand how it works.
When you say off the record.
And by the way, if he had said I'm off the record and then disparage his coworkers, wouldn't that be a leak?
That would exactly.
Which he's constantly complaining about?
He's what saying, he's I want to fire everyone. Clean up. Yeah. Yes, indeed.
Sydney, your two buddies here are more sanguine than you are, it sounds
like. Well, I think it has less to do with Trump's failure to govern and more to do with the Republican Party's massive scam on the American people. I think it has to do with the fact that the people elected to govern in red areas do not actually represent the interests of the people that they claim to represent. And we can attribute that to a lot of the activism we saw in the halls of Congress, you know, when people with disabilities showed up and said, we're not going to let you take away our health care. I mean,
that's the other check and balance, right?
Exactly.
There are three branches and you have the American people. So my question was, does Trump have less power than you imagined or feared early on? Or are you just as troubled, worried?
I'm just as troubled because his power is over his domain, right? But I think this has more to do with the dysfunction of the Republican Party in Congress than anything else. So maybe that dysfunction is some sort of check on his power. But I don't think it's another branch of government stepped in to contradict him in a sense.
Well, yes, it did in a way, because if you think about it, Trump Care had 17% approval. And these members of Congress, Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, and apparently John McCain, know that. They know it's unpopular. So that's where they're coming from. You know, Trump 101 is when in a hole, keep digging. And also don't forget to dig another hole. And that's what happened this week with the transgender thing. He didn't like the conversation. He's very good at driving it. So he says, oh, and while I'm at it, let me tweet out this new policy for the military. No transgender in the military. And then all the people who are in the military are left. The generals are saying, we didn't have that conversation. That's not going to happen. We're going with the old policy.
Is John McCain getting too much of the credit or blame, by the way, for his no vote when Senator Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski were even more adamant all the way along in defying their party?
Well, I just think that there was more drama with him. People maybe didn't know which way he was going to go. He made some confusing statements and votes. He was talking about voting for a bill at one point that he hoped wouldn't pass, you know, and asking for a guarantee that if the bill passed, it would go to a conference committee with the House. So it put him in a very strange spot. I did talk with a Senate aide, an aide to Maria Cantwell this morning, who said that his take was that McCain, you know, governors play in this. The governors are, in many cases, in some of these Republican states, have said, you know, this really isn't going to work for us. I have to deal with the Medicaid system and the patients who are going to be affected by this. And this aide to Cantwell said that he thought that maybe McCain, it really just came down to the governor of Arizona told him, look, this is really not good for the state of Arizona.
And possibly his experience just a week before, knowing the kind of medical care that he was able to afford and how hypocritical it would be to go in there and say, well, I think I'll vote that everyone else doesn't have the same health care I have. I mean, that could have been a factor. He didn't really explain it that well. But I think the credit should be shared among the three of them.
Yeah, I think he gets far too much attention. And this bewildering maverick tag has followed him around for years, despite the fact that most of the time he votes along party lines. So when he doesn't vote along party lines, when he splits, that's when the attention is directed to him. And he can claim this maverick title when really it's the exception to the rule.
I've thought about what the lasting damage is that Trump has done that, let's say, Marco Rubio wouldn't have done. And I wonder, you know, because what's the alternative? Is it about Republican policies or Trump in particular? And I wonder, what about the minority baiting of many kinds? This week, Trump outdid himself with a rant about sadistic illegal immigrant gang members using knives to slice and dice young, beautiful girls. Mm. Do you think that's, if he's an unpopular president when it's said and done, and we don't know, is that the kind of thing that just rolls off and makes and just discredits those kinds of views? Or do you think he has a lasting impact on society, whether he gets policy through or not.
Well, President Chaos, which is a good way to refer to him, does specialize in alienating people and trying to constantly change the conversation. He has demeaned us all, I feel, by just this nonstop. He's in a fight with everybody every day, and anyone who opposes him couldn't possibly have a point because they're failing or all the other words that he uses to describe everybody who's his opponent, or if you just even disagree with him. I mean, Lisa Murkowski could be counted on to vote with him on a variety of other things, but he spent the week just trashing her, Twitter trashing her. And, you know, I don't think it's a successful strategy. I think it does bring all of us down because of the sort of corrosive effect on the dialogue.
By the way, Susan Collins, a senator from Maine, was caught on mic. First of all, a congressman from Texas said that if Collins were a man from South Texas, he might challenge her to a duel over her healthcare stance. And then she was caught on mic making fun of his looks. She said he's so unattractive, it's unbelievable. And I'm not saying that's the same as men mocking women for their looks, but it is related. On the record, men also sometimes get belittled for their weight and their age and their attractiveness.
I would argue that maybe there's no such thing as reverse sexism, but that's a different conversation for a different day.
Right.
With regards to what Joni was talking about, I think that Trump is actually playing to his strengths with those comments, which is the most disturbing part of all. He's doing something that the center and the right accuse the left of doing all the time, which is identity politics. He is playing into his base's identity politics. He's going for white might and white fear and the weird masculinity issues that accompany that. And that's, I think that probably is more effective in riling up his base than going after transgender people on Twitter.
Well, let's get at the politics of the Seattle variety in just a moment and some debate and maybe confusion over the brand new distracted driving law that kicked in this weekend and more coming up on The Week in Review. KOW's Week in Review, continuing now with Jim Bruner and Sidney Brownstone and Joni Balter. I'm Bill Radke. The election is Tuesday. Depending where you live, you are deciding on a sales tax for the arts, legislative seat, school board, port commission, and who's going to be mayor of Seattle. The Times endorsed Jenny Durkin in the primary. The Stranger endorsed Carrie Moon, although Sidney Brownstone on the Stranger board, you dissented from that publicly, you and a few others.
Yeah, we did. We actually wrote a dissent in favor of Nikita Oliver.
Yeah. So when the Stranger puts out its printable cheat sheet for how to vote, which candidate shows up or do they both?
It's gonna show Carrie Moon's name. And the cheat sheet is really the thrust of the Stranger's endorsement. A lot of people look at that cheat sheet and don't read anything else. Whether you think that's unfortunate is up to you, I guess. But the Stranger did vote to endorse Carrie Moon.
Jim Bruner, Seattle Times. Does the Times ever split out its endorsement board and talk about disagreement?
Well, I mean, first of all, as a reporter, I have nothing to do with the endorsement process. That's the opinion page. I think in some past years, the Times used to endorse two candidates to go through the primary. Seems like they've now decided that it's more effective to just pick one and give people a choice. But again, I wasn't on the inside of those conversations, and I don't want to take credit or blame for what they wrote.
Well, no,
Joni, who did Civic Cocktail Board endorse?
Okay, so of course they don't endorse. To that point, I felt that a lot of people were waiting very anxiously to see who the Stranger was going to endorse, and they ended up diluting it by doing this 5-4 thing. And so that's confusing. It sort of reduces the power of any endorsement, and not in specific. Having been on the inside of the Seattle Times endorsements and lost many a battle for this or that candidate, I can tell you that you say who you're endorsing and the other people. In the old days, we did if we wanted to challenge an endorsement under way different editorial directors. We were able to disagree respectfully with the House endorsement. As time went on, we did a lot less of that.
Publicly, you got to get...
In the paper, yes.
They would print a sort of dissent. You mean just in a column?
Not as an editorial.
Yes.
The House editorial, you win or lose on those.
Yeah.
You take your lumps and you go talk to yourself about that.
What's your prediction? Which two make it through this primary? Jim Bruner?
Well, you know, I spent some time on the streets, and not scientific, of course, because only one person, myself and our City Hall reporter, Dan Beekman, went around and talked to a lot of people. You know, and based on that and what I've been seeing on social media and just my sense of the race, I think that Jenny Durkin is a favorite to get through. She has most of the money, a lot of the establishment support. The second person is really up in the air. I did find this week a lot of energy for Nikita Oliver, who's, you know, younger candidate, less well-known, hasn't run for office before, but has kind of captured a certain energy. Her issue, I think, is a lot of her supporters, I think, are younger. And typically in an August primary, the voting age, the people who participate skew wider and older. And it's just going to be interesting to see if she can get through. But I could make an argument for a lot of the other candidates in the race to possibly get through, too. Jessen Farrell, Bob Asagawa, Mike McGinn almost by, I don't want to say inertia, but name ID. It doesn't seem
that's not a prediction. That's a list.
I know it is. Yeah. So I'll give you one.
Yeah.
The other, I'm saying I'm really torn. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really unknown. Sydney, what's your prediction?
Well, don't discount the power of the stranger's endorsement. You did not mention Carrie Moon. I think that Carrie Moon could be a contender. But part of the reason why I dissented and helped write an editorial backing Nikita Oliver is because I think her candidacy actually has the power to change the dynamics of who participates in elections going forward. If she makes it through the primary, it would be a huge signal to her base, to younger people, to more disenfranchised parts of the city, that they have a voice, that they have a stake in the electoral process. And I think that if she gets through, I'm excited to see what would happen in future August primaries. You know, maybe it wouldn't be such a given that it skews whiter and older and wealthier.
What do you think? Do you think it's true or false? It's going to skew that way.
I honestly don't
know.
Yeah.
Joni Balter?
So I agree with some of what Jim said here. Jenny Durkin is most likely to survive as one of the finalists. The second one is way more up in the air. Your sort of textbook approach to this would tell you that it would be former Mayor Mike McGinn, just on the name familiarity, because the folks who do tend to vote in the primaries are going to know that name. The other names, there's so many of them, it's very hard to predict how you're going to divide those numbers. And literally any of them could win, any of the top six could win. You can make a case. So I think it's McGinn, and then I talk to people, and I don't hear a lot of enthusiasm for him. I do hear the enthusiasm for Nikita Oliver, but does it translate to votes? Not so sure about that. So really, it's Jenny Durkin plus someone who we will find out on the 12th of never because of the way we count ballots here.
Yeah. Meanwhile, you could make an argument for, you know, there are two state legislators basically in the race who have an electoral base in the city. Jessen Farrell, she stepped down from her state representative seat in North Seattle, but people know her there. She's known in the, you know, transit urbanist community, too. You can make a case for her definitely getting through. Bob Asagawa in the 11th District, Beacon Hill, been around for a long time, has a geographical base, too. Was a big Bernie Sanders guy, national delegate to the Democratic National Convention for Bernie Sanders. So he has some volunteers out of that past, too.
Sounds like we might have to wait 4 days for an election. And Joni, you said we might not know then.
Well, you know, we're going to count every last ballot that came in from Kathmandu, so it could take a while.
All right. Ballots due Tuesday, postmarked or dropped. There was another development this week in the city of Seattle. The current mayor, Ed Murray, had been accused of statutory rape, and that lawsuit was later dropped. But this week, that accuser, Delvon Heckard, filed a defamation claim against Murray and the city. Jim, how does Heckard claim that Murray defamed him?
Yeah, he filed a claim with the city clerk's office, which is a precursor to a lawsuit. You have to file one of these claims and then give the city a chance to respond. He basically is saying that Ed Murray, as mayor, used his public office to defame him by basically saying that, you know, he'd made false claims against Ed Murray and insinuating or suggesting outright that those claims were somehow politically motivated and were part of some kind of right-wing conspiracy.
That's the key, right? Insinuating or stated outright? Because doesn't he have to prove a false statement against him?
That could be what it comes down to legally, or it could come down to the city's risk manager saying, do we want to fight this out? Or is it, you know, a lot of these, sometimes these cases settle. It just got filed, the claim. You know, there isn't even a lawsuit yet. I think it's, I don't really have a sense of how it's going to play out. Got to give it a little more time.
This doesn't go to a judge. It's up to the city to decide whether the city or Murray owes this man money, right?
Well,
The city rules on the claim.
In the claims process,
yeah
the city will have to decide whether they want to settle. Yeah. There could be a lawsuit.
Mm-hmm.
My experience with the city, unfortunately, is that if a person who's inebriated falls down on the sidewalk and you can find a little crack there, a little elevation, the city pays a lot of these. So this isn't the longest bet. It does sort of change the story a little bit in this way, that we were told that the goal was to, you know, get the truth out. Now the goal is to get some money. That changes what this lawyer Lincoln Beauregard was saying. You know, somebody's going to have to pay the bills, I guess. And so they've decided that the city taxpayers should do that. I'm not sure I buy that as an argument, but I think there's a chance that the claim would be paid, some settlement.
Well, a civil suit also seeks damages. So you could say that in any case, one of the motivations is to seek money. And what you were talking about earlier about the insinuation, did Ed Murray insinuate that the motivation was political? I mean, he wrote in an editorial published on my paper, Slog, our website, that the headline was, "The motivation is political." So I don't know how you could get any clearer than that.
But does that hold up for him to say that getting at someone's motivation, is that a demonstrably, provably false, defamatory statement? That's the question, right?
If I had to guess, I think that Lincoln Beauregard is trying another route to get the truth out there, because he would have to affirmatively prove that his motivation is false, right? He would have to prove that Del Vaughn's motivation is because he was allegedly sexually abused, right? That's just another way of moving the argument forward.
Hmm. Also, I think Heckard would have to show damages.
Correct. That's where it gets a little trickier, yes, indeed, because you're trying to show some kind of defamation, and what is his own record? That's another problem for them here.
Okay,
At the same time, let's not lose sight of the fact that Ed Murray is the mayor of Seattle, and it's a legitimate question to ask, has he been using the city resources inappropriately? You know, whether or not this legal claim stands up, I don't know, but... You know, this has always been a civil matter. There's no criminal case against Ed Murray. The remedy per se was always going to be how what the perception was in the public mind, and possible monetary damages.
So many of the press conferences that you were press conferences about other things, places where the mayor was out and about doing other things, and he's asked the question. Now, if he has the city of Seattle logo behind him, that's the question of how much he was using that. But was it in the course of a press conference? The one press conference that I can think of, I would call the vindication, I'm vindicated press conference, which was clearly at City Hall. Many of the other events, for example, the press conference that the mayor and his lawyer called was in the lawyer's office. And this is the one where, demeaning as it was, he had to describe his private parts. Oh, my gosh.
That was his decision to host that meeting, by the
way. Of course it was. Of course it was, and he used his lawyer's office. And he also hired outside counsel and outside PR. So this is pretty close. You have to decide what you are defaming here and all of that.
I spoke to an associate professor of psychology who specializes in child abuse and trauma at Oregon State University. And I spoke to her after the wake of the what Jim and Lewis Cam published earlier this month about
The Seattle Times,
the 1984 Child Protective Services report concluding that Ed Murray had sexually abused his foster son, Jeff Simpson. And in response, Ed Murray's lawyer, Catherine Heekin, said that CPS, Child Protective Services, is supposed to err on the side of believing the child. Now, data shows that that's actually not true. Only 10% of child sexual abuses cases disclosed to CPS actually ever get a substantiated finding. And we know that 58% of disclosures are screened out. Only a minority of those cases make it to trial. So undermining the integrity of Child Protective Services is different when you're defending yourself in a private lawsuit than being an elected official and taking this stand. That's what she said. I think that we have to look at the totality of Ed Murray and his supporters' statements about these child sexual abuse allegations starting 4 months ago, and to really understand the impact it's had on the city. I don't think this is something that you can say, oh, let's keep it out of the court of public opinion, because by saying keep it out of the court of public opinion, you are issuing an opinion about it. And as Jim mentioned, there are no criminal charges, so the criminal justice system is never going to step up and address this. This has always been about public perception.
But what we have here is we have a situation where we're all trying to decide, true or false. We really haven't given him the presumption of innocence, and we're trying to judge this in the media. You know, there are procedures to decide what's true. We don't know what's true. I don't know what happened. You don't know what happened. And the CPS worker is doing their best job to be fair to the valid concerns of victims or alleged victims.
But Joni, you're also saying that there are procedures to handle what we know is true. You're also expressing faith in those systems. And what I'm saying is that I don't think that the criminal justice system is trauma-informed enough to even handle these allegations.
So should the media decide then?
I'm not saying that the media should. I think that the citizens of Seattle should decide whether he is someone we want to have serving as our mayor.
How are they going to decide? He's already taken himself out of the race.
Well, it came up in city council whether the grounds were there to.
And they're not going to proceed on that based on what they have now. Now, if something else comes out, they might.
Okay, Jim, I'll finish this up.
Yeah, of course, we don't know for sure what happened 33 years ago in this case. The point of the story that Lewis Kam and I wrote, and Lewis really bird-dogged these records out of the state of Oregon that we thought had been destroyed, what it did show is that some of the mayor and his defender's statements, previous statements where they said that these 1984 allegations had been proven false or were totally debunked, that those were not really true. That's more complicated than that. Again, Ed Murray denies this, and you know, I think he has a right to defend himself, and it's a really touchy, tricky situation. When you're talking about potential survivors of sexual abuse, we don't know what happened, but these records got us closer to the actual investigation than we ever had seen before in 1984, and the reports showed what they showed.
Okay, that's the defamation claim against the city of Seattle. We'll see if it turns into a lawsuit. We'll see who gets through to the primary. That's coming up on Tuesday. Lots to watch in the city of Seattle. And coming up on the Week in Review, distracted driving, nefarious walking, should we decriminalize jaywalking? And we don't all have paid sick leave in the first place, but do we all deserve to have a mental health day off work? That's all coming up. KUOW's Week in Review today with Joni Balter, Sidney Brownstone, and Jim Bruner. And there was confusion and debate this week about our new state distracted driving law that took effect on Sunday. You are now not allowed to hold your phone and text while you drive. And the more controversial part is if you get pulled over and ticketed for swerving, and the officer thinks you swerved because you were distracted by your coffee or your French fries, your mascara, the dog in your lap, you can get an additional ticket. So I asked State Patrol Trooper Chase Van Cleve, how do you decide whether my coffee contributed to my swerve?
Personally, when I make a traffic stop, I have to have some proof or belief or evidence to think that that coffee played a factor in why I stopped you. I can't just go up and see a coffee cup in there. And this is, again, me speaking personally. Just because I see a coffee cup doesn't mean it was involved. Just because it... you know, you have it in your hand or you were taking a drink, doesn't necessarily mean that it's at fault for that lane change. I have to have a reason to believe that.
But what would you witness in my coffee drinking? Would it have to be my coffee? I have to fly out of my hand and splash all over my front windshield?
Sure. I mean, if I were to walk up to you and there was, you said, you know, I spilt my coffee or I spilt my drink and there's a large coffee stain on you or on the floor, there would be evidence there to show that was an attributing factor. You know, if I were to walk up and there was mustard or ketchup from, you know, the hot dog that's right next to you and you'd say I spilt it or I lost it. And you know, as I'm next to you or behind you in my patrol car and I see you fumbling all over the place for it, that would lead me to believe that that was a factor in that sort of thing.
Okay, so some people don't like the idea that cops might police your food stains, your coffee cups, your lipstick tube. There is an online petition to repeal that part of the law. Is anyone here bothered by the police ticketing you as a secondary offense if they think they know why you were speeding or swerving?
So I'm not bothered by it. I think that the way that your interview went It sort of favors people who don't do laundry, if you think about it, so that you have a pre-existing coffee spill. This is, Jim's looking.
Yeah.
I see it.
Usually
I got it.
There is some. And I don't know, can you dust for coffee?
Yeah, you can dust for coffee.
What kind of evidence are they going to talk about here?
So this is Seattle and Washington State. And so drinking coffee while you drive is actually mandatory here. This is one thing that you missed in that interview.
Yeah, that's RCW 24.
It's must drink coffee while driving.
Uh-huh.
So clearly, I'm not bothered by that as a secondary thing. If it's all over the car, as your guy said, maybe it was a factor. If you were throwing the coffee around, you couldn't see.
But the petitioners say, why does the cause of my swerve matter? Isn't the swerving the only thing you should penalize?
Well, we can raise more money if we hit you for the flying coffee as well.
Oh, so it's about the state printing money. Is that
printing
it?
Money, yes.
I am generally a proponent of the war on cars, 100%. I think that if there are any added incentives to take public transit over driving, like I'm behind that 100%. And, same with the distracted driving law. When I first heard about it, I was like, good, great. More people will walk, more people will take public transit if it's available to them. On the other hand, I think we do need to be careful about increasing penalties for traffic violations because we know that Black and Hispanic drivers are disproportionately policed for driving infractions. In 2012, the Washington State Task Force on Race and Criminal Justice found that minority drivers are cited more frequently and charged with more serious offenses than white drivers. And a Seattle Times report actually from 2000 found that Black drivers in Seattle had twice the risk of getting a ticket over white drivers. So I think that's something to be careful of. And I'm not sure I would entrust the Washington State Troopers with pulling people over for coffee.
They don't pull over for coffee. It's secondary.
Well, right. But suspecting that there may be coffee in the hand of a Black person driving. I don't know. That rubs me the wrong way.
Yeah, a KOW listener elaborated on that. Travis wrote that this law empowers undertrained law enforcement to profile people in cars under false pretenses, adding to an ornate set of codes that ensnare vulnerable communities in a web of debt and legal trouble.
Well, and the issue of debt arising out of traffic infractions is a serious one. You know, people, they get in debt, and we've had issues in the city, too, with people having their cars impounded and things like that, and it does become a cycle. I think, you know, I hope that there's some data collection built into this and that the legislature can go back and or academics can look at how it's used. I'm sure that will happen. Maybe, you know, our newspaper will look at it, too.
So I think we should keep the focus on the bigger picture here, which is that we have learned in recent years that distracted driving, using your cell phone in the ways that many people have been doing really recklessly, is causing more traffic deaths. And so we should train our officers to do it properly, but to enforce it. That's how we do traffic laws. That's how we did the seatbelt law. That's how we're going to do this one.
I try to enforce the law myself with my horn when I am in the car.
How's that?
I play a game called Drunk or Texting when I see somebody in front of me. And you can tell their heads.
So wait a
down.
Minute. Somebody
always,
is.
Wait a minute.
When they're turning left, they're always at the left turn light. Anyway, don't get me started.
So someone is driving and texting, and you're going to blare your horn at them as well.
Do you not know that?
I'm trying to snap them back into focus.
Yeah, but what do they do when they're snapped into focus? Do they jerk the wheel?
They flip me off.
They flip you off.
But do you not know that also is distracted and that we don't honk that much here unless we let it, you know?
Well, a well-placed honk is a good thing.
I agree.
You don't have to be obnoxious about it.
Can it be like the quiet honk?
It's informational.
It's too noisy.
It's an informational toot. It's a little
rude.
Yep. We need another setting on our horn. So there can be an angry horn if you're going to do that.
Or get off your phone.
Or just say, hey, I'm letting you, the light just turned green, the arrow just turned, and there's only a few cars going to get through this intersection. You're in the lead. This is it's your responsibility to move immediately, toot.
Maybe it can be the voice, a recording of Anthony Scaramucci talking to the New Yorker reporter.
Wow. By the way.
By the way.
Yeah. That. How long is he going to last?
About 2 weeks.
The Mooch.
About 2 weeks.
I bet
the rate
Trump
he's
loves
going.
Him.
I know Trump loves them, and they do this hand gestures. Did you see the video where they do the same exact hand gestures, which makes them fellow hand gesturers, I guess is the right word there. But he's just too flamboyant. He's the communications director and doesn't know that when you call a reporter, hi, this is off the record, not just say it, wait for them to say, yes, I heard you. Because otherwise, we don't know how this is going to go, especially with the tirade he was going to have.
he just got a little horn honking of attention.
Indeed.
You know, snap him back in. But we'll see if he lasts or if Reince Priebus lasts.
Yes. And thank you for snapping us back to the topic, which was, we just can't quit you, Scaramucci. I got to say, it's only a few days old. I'm living proof that the new texting law gets people on public transit more. I've been using public transit the last 2 weeks because I tried to learn my Siri on my iPhone and figured out I can't do all the things that I was honestly sometimes doing with my thumb. And so I've been on light rail and bus most of the last 2 weeks.
I thought you were going to say that.
And it's great. It is fantastic. I am working way more than I was. We're going to talk about what you owe your employer in just a moment. And I'm walking. I've been jogging across campus, all that kind
Bill,
of stuff.
Bill, can we recruit you to the war on cars now?
I'm on
over to the dark side.
You just did.
I thought you were going to say
it's a sunny, warm side so far. It's going to get dark in a few months, though.
I thought you were going to say you were reformed and you got off your phone. That's what you were supposed to say.
Oh, heck no. Actually, and we're going to talk about that, being tied to your work, not just with a phone, but with a little chip under your hand. That actually happened this week. That's in a moment. Before we leave the roads, I just want to ask, should we decriminalize jaywalking? Maybe we should, is what a Seattle lawmaker suggested this week. Councilmember Lorena Gonzalez said plenty of people ignore the jaywalking law anyway. Plus, she cited a Seattle Times report that black people are disproportionately ticketed for jaywalking. Does anyone here think we should stop ticketing for jaywalking?
Absolutely. Decriminalize it.
Completely.
Yep.
Don't enforce it.
Yeah.
So here's what
Why? Just for all those reasons.
Yeah, I mean, disproportional policing. Also, I think there's a pretty strong civic culture in Seattle of never jaywalking in the first place. I learned this when I moved from New York. Everyone waits on the sidewalk in a very orderly fashion, which means I can jaywalk to my heart's delight because I know that no car is going to run over me. They're going to stop.
But do you want to abandon that civic, that hallmark of Seattle? Aren't we leaving that behind?
So we are known for being the gentle people who wait for the walk line.
Yes.
Even in the middle of the night, 3 a.m., it's raining, no one's around, no cars. You'll see Seattleites standing there waiting for the light to change. You know, the history of the jaywalking law here in Seattle is simply ebb and flow. It depends on the mayor. It depends on who on the city council is making a big deal of this. I'm talking about the enforcement. So one day when I was writing a Seattle Times column, I called up the traffic safety folks and I said, "Are you enforcing this much?" It had some bland answer. I said, "Okay, I'm going to jaywalk my way from the Seattle Times to your office, and we'll see what happens." Mm-hmm. I jaywalked 17 times on my way down there. In front of police cars, everything, no one said a word.
Well, you're a white lady, Joni.
I understand, but not everything.
The statute of limitations.
Just having a different conversation here for one second. Really? Okay, worried about that. So at some point,
some more enforcement. Someone come and arrest Joni Balter.
Please do. So at some point, you know, we will have, and we do have these pedestrian deaths, and you'll wish that we had a jaywalking law. What I'm seeing on the streets are a bunch of folks new to the city, don't know where they're going, and they're on their phones while they're walking. So maybe we should have a jaywalking law.
Maybe we should have a distracted walking law.
Distracted walking.
I mean, I think it's, most people would probably say, if the police are spending very much time enforcing the jaywalking law, they should probably be doing something else. I'm not sure that the right answer is necessarily to get rid of the law, but
decriminalizing would be non-enforcement, right?
Right.
Yeah. You in favor?
No, I don't know. To be honest, I haven't really thought about it a lot. But
the Times piece quoted police saying that you can't draw conclusions from those jaywalking statistics because the small number of tickets, then the lack of circumstantial information, and the pitfalls of comparing Seattle's population to those who were ticketed. What does that mean? Did that piece tell us anything about jaywalking?
I think it did go over the data on what data was available and show that there was potentially disproportionate enforcement, which is a serious thing, and maybe it should be looked at more.
It is serious, and it goes right back to that training thing about, you know, that the officers have to be very careful that they don't pick on certain groups. They have to do that. But that doesn't mean you throw out the whole law. That's ridiculous. We have people walking around in a stupor on their phones, and they're going to get hit, and that's not a good day at the office. It's not. Haha, segue.
There is an advantage to jaywalking, though. When the light turns green and all the pedestrians fill the crosswalk, no cars can turn right. They have to wait for the crosswalk to clear, which backs up traffic. If you have a chance to jaywalk when the intersection is clear and safe and empty, you're one less person clogging up the crosswalk.
And then Jim's going to honk at you, so I don't know.
Jim's going to honk at me anyway.
Yeah.
Councilmember Rob Johnson told Como that research shows jaywalking can be safer, quote, because you're doing something you know you're not supposed to be doing, so you look a little more intentionally and you spend a little more time not on your phone.
This is
Although, like, if we decriminalize it, wouldn't you no longer be doing something you're not supposed to be doing?
That's a good point, because that's like the argument that if about bicycles, you know, worried about the same issues. If there's more bicycles, studies have shown that's safer, even though it sounds counterintuitive, that because people in that area are used to, now I got to look for the bicycles. Look how many there are.
Yep. Okay. So we talked about, at least I'm on transit more than I used to be, because I can't be so productive. I can't be a one-man office in my 2000 Camry. So we're going to talk about being tethered to your work in different ways. What are your rights as an employee? How far are you willing to go for your employer? Chip in the hand, mental health day, all coming up on The Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke on The Week in Review. I'm with Seattle Times political reporter Jim Bruner, The Stranger's political reporter Sydney Brownstone, and from the Seattle Channel, Civic Cocktail host Joni Balter. Finally, we're going to talk about what you will do for your employer. It came up a couple of ways this week. A Wisconsin technology company announced it will implant a radio frequency ID chip in the hand of any employee who wants it. Most of their employees have said, yeah, I'll take that. With this tiny chip between thumb and forefinger, they can wave their hand and open the company door, log into their computers, work the copy machines, and pay for snacks from the company vending machines. Now, this only works if you're 6 inches from the chip reader. It's not a GPS. It doesn't send out your location like the phone that you carry so willingly does. Does anyone here think this is coming to Amazon and Microsoft, and obviously the Stranger will adopt it? Is this our near future in Seattle?
I'd say it's a computer chip too far. Let's not do this. This is nuts. I mean, those of us who work at some of these institutions or have worked in different cases, you're already giving these folks like 10, 12, 13 hours a day. Now they want to know where you are at night. They tell you that they don't.
Wait, how do they know where you are at night?
You just have a chip reader. They don't have a GPS. That's in the next installment. I would say this is way too much.
Slippery slope.
Way too much. I mean, the horror of pulling out your card to buy your food, not that hard. The badges that we're wearing in here, I don't know if they open anything, but the other badges do. They open doors.
Yeah, what's wrong with a lanyard?
What's wrong with
What about putting the chip on your ring finger? If you really need a chip on your hand, what?
Yeah, it doesn't need to be implanted. Or I'm going to open up a shop that removes them.
Obviously, if it's voluntary, that's one thing. But, you know, what is voluntary in the workplace? If your boss, if corporate management is saying, this is voluntary, but, you know, it'd be really nice if you all did it, that's a problem. You know, at Seattle Times, we have a union. I'm sure that would be a subject to bargaining, of course. Maybe some workplaces that had unions could push back on that kind of thing.
But would the unions bargain away their right to not have a chip in their hand?
Well, how much would we get a pay raise? I don't know.
Well, maybe.
You would always get a pay raise.
Wait,
from what I understand.
Is it true that Seattle Times reporters can't smoke weed?
Is that a policy?
I think that might be true of new ones. I don't.
Okay.
There was an old drug testing policy. Yeah. I think it got revised. I don't know the details.
Okay. Just curious. I think that putting a chip in someone is funny because it's so absurd. It definitely has the problems with it that Jim mentioned. And I think it's only a matter of time until someone starts selling that information to health insurance companies.
Or worse.
Yeah.
What information? The information about that you got some snacks from the vending machine?
Yeah, how active
you got the
you
wrong
are.
Snacks from the vending machine. There's
yeah,
good, right, and wrong.
Yeah, your cholesterol, et cetera. I mean, that's already happening with our online footprints.
Yeah, you're at work for 14 hours a day, you know.
Yeah.
Jim was at work for 14 hours, but you were only there for 11.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we're going to get there with in a moment about how much you work and how much you don't. I just wonder before we leave RFID chips, where are you uncomfortable with how much you give your life over to your job? Do you have any analog here to the chip?
So I think after you put in your 8, 10, 12, that's enough. But, you know, in the news business that all of us are in, the phone calls come, the questions come, hey, something just happened. So you better find some way to be separate from the job.
So someone thinks that you're nuts for working that many hours. That is That's how they look. You have a chip. Nuts. You have a chip in your hand from the point of view of somebody who doesn't work as much as you do, right?
Yeah. I mean,
what you do is abnormal until it's normal to you.
That's true. I mean, but I think it's unhealthy the way that I think about my identity. For example, like I would define myself by my job first and foremost, rather than like a human being second. And I think that's problematic because I think that in the United States, we rely on this idea of people who are crazed about working, and we still have this myth of a meritocracy that, you know, if you are poor or if you are unhealthy, that just means that you're not working hard enough. And I think that can actually translate into really detrimental policies. Like the United States is still lagging behind the rest of the developed world in terms of paid maternity leave.
But these employers might say, I've got a chip in my hand. I don't define myself by my work.
I want a chip on my shoulder. That's where I want the chip.
They use the syringe, they put a chip in, they can take it out, and it's only weird because it seems weird.
Yeah.
And it's not weird to them. Uh-huh. But this brings us to another conversation we had this week about your job. If you are lucky enough to have a job with sick leave, you probably take a sick day when you have the flu, but probably not, or maybe not, if you are feeling depressed or traumatized or just mentally exhausted. But why isn't that worth a sick day? I talked to a woman who advocates for workers with mental health problems. Catherine Switz said she knows how hard it is to say, I deserve this time off.
Even now, running a mental health nonprofit, the Stability Network, I still have trouble turning to my colleagues and saying, I'm going to take a mental health day. Even though I have a mental health condition and I work in this industry, I still feel shame and internalized stigma from doing it, you know, 20 years after my diagnosis. So it's very deep and it's very powerful. So what I'm trying to say is take a day off for sure. Call it maybe not a mental health day, but take it. Take the day off.
Call it a sick day.
Call it a sick day.
Call it a sick day for now. You can keep the details private. But she wants you to consider telling your boss why you need a sick day for your mental well-being. We need to stand up and make mental health days normal. Sydney, you are nodding vigorously.
Yeah, I am so happy that we're talking about this on the show because I think mental health days should be as embraced, if not more so, than physical illness days. Although mental health conditions are physical illness. Our brains are part of our bodies, right? And I actually have a story that I think goes to the heart of this. When I was a fellow, I was working as a fact checker at Mother Jones in California, not making a ton of money, but fact checkers often stay late into the night doing the brunt of the work before the magazine comes out. And I had just finished fact checking this really long, really amazing piece on post-traumatic stress disorder, but it required talking to a lot of people with PTSD and while they relived certain experiences. So that took a toll. And then immediately after was the Sandy Hook shooting. And in the immediate aftermath, our editors decided that we wanted to put together a database of everyone killed in a mass shooting in the year 2012. And so another fellow and I were responsible for writing mini obituaries about everyone who had been killed in a mass shooting. And I had the Sandy Hook kids, which meant that I was looking for details like her favorite color was pink. She had just learned how to tie her shoes. We knocked that out in 3 days. We did a ton of work and the package was really well received. I was really proud of it. What I found the next day after walking down the street, though, I just burst into tears. I couldn't stop crying. I came to my job. I sat down at my desk, couldn't stop crying. I was humiliated. I was embarrassed. This had never happened to me before. And I just tried to white knuckle it through. I tried to get through the day, tried to do my job because I myself felt like I was weak for not being able to do it. And I asked some folks for advice and they were like, you should just tell your supervisor, tell your research editor. And that's what I did. I went to this woman, her name was Maddie, and she was incredibly kind and incredibly understanding. And she said, you know what? You take a day. And when we come back, I'm going to move your desk to a different place. Maybe you just need a change of scene. And that did wonders. But more than the change of scene and having the day, it was the understanding from the people I worked with that I deserve this time off and that I wasn't weak for taking it. And I think that should be applied to every job, especially for people who are using their heart and their soul in addition to their brain when they're working. And I know reporters and social workers are oftentimes those people.
That's such a good story, and I'm really glad you told it. You know, it's all about the trust that mm-hmm. you were referring to. So we're really debating here, should you call in well or call in sick? How do you describe it? You're still going to take the day some of the time. It's how you describe it. And that comes from the rapport with an understanding boss like the one you just described. And we've all had the ones who are understanding and the ones who don't have a clue. So it really does come down to that.
Right, and it comes down to the privilege that I had and the comfort that I had in being able to talk to a boss, because not everyone has that comfort, and until they do, we're still going to have to use terms like sick days instead of mental health days.
What if you think your boss doesn't have that understanding that sick time is for your mental well-being?
Then you call in sick.
Then you lie.
Well, you are sick. If the boss is asked, you're sick in your terms. You're sick in your own terms.
Keep it at that.
I think there's a sense in which if you have the benefit of being able to take, you know, sick days or time off for whatever it is, personal time. I mean, a lot of workplaces describe these things differently. You know, you should be able, of course, to tell your boss or manager what's really going on, and there shouldn't be a stigma to a mental health day. But at the same time, maybe, you know, it shouldn't be like a requirement that you have to explain yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Just, I need to take this day off.
Do you really have to explain yourself? I think some of us might assume that we have to.
Sometimes yes, and sometimes no.
In fact, we all have colleagues who need to tell you about the wheezing sound when they breathe and their mucus and everything, as if you have to talk about what your symptoms are.
I think brevity is really important in a case like this. You don't need to embellish it. Hi, I'm not coming in today. I don't feel well.
Quick comments from some people are on Twitter listening to us right now. Lisa says, I worked for a place where we could just ask, hey, I need to take a mental health day. End of story. Everyone was happy. So that exists, as we said. Lynn says, you just call in sick like you would for any other reason you don't feel good. And Carhu says, I don't ask. I tell my employer that I'm taking one. I'm very fortunate.
There are times when my boss says, I need a mental health day. Could you stay home?
Could you stay home and give me a break?
I've worked with you, Jim. I understand. That's it.
So do you think this is our, I ask sort of like the chip in a different way. Do you think this is our future? Do you think, here we are having the conversation now as she's asking us to do. Don't just take a sick day and stay mum. Talk about it and tell your boss.
Part of working for another person is training that person to be a good boss. And so this develops over time. The ability to say the actual truth, you know, it's a minute. Okay, I don't feel well, followed by another sentence or not. I actually need a mental health day, or my head hurts, or whatever else hurts. So it's a matter of the training and the development of the rapport, how many sentences you should say.
Yeah, and I think if you feel comfortable talking about it, you should, but you shouldn't feel ashamed if those aren't your circumstances right now. I think what's important is that we as a society moving forward are becoming increasingly aware of mental health conditions like clinical depression, anxiety, and the vast numbers of post-traumatic stress in civilian populations, not just in combat veterans as well.
I feel better just having talked to you all about this.
You're calling in what?
Calling in, I'm feeling a little mental healthier right now for having talked it out. We've got a weekend coming up for some of us. Enjoy that if it's just what you need. And I want to thank all of you for coming in and breaking down the week. Jim Bruner, Seattle Times, thanks.
Thank you.
Joni Balter, Civic Cocktail, good to see you. Thank you.
Good to see you.
Cindy Brownstone, good story. Thank you for telling that.
Thank you.
From The Stranger, political reporter Sydney Brownstone, all of us will be watching some politics here in the next few days. Remember, primary ballot due on Tuesday. And join us next Friday for another Week in Review.